but I paid attention to her.
Okay, good afternoon. We'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 2:49 p.m., April 5th, 2012. With me this afternoon is Co-Chair Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire, myself, Stedman, and Senator Olson will be joining us shortly. He just stepped out of the room. Up this afternoon, we have one bill on the agenda, Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax. Senator Hoffman may have a motion to adopt committee substitute version O.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 192 Finance / O as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation and ask Mr. Peterson to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. The committee substitute that was just moved is version O. The first 2.5 pages of the title of the bill. I won't read it because we only have a few hours. Section 1 of the bill stays the same. Section 2 of the bill is the minimum floor tax provision. That's been changed so that now small producers, which are defined as producers that produce less than 50,000 barrels per day, are exempt from the minimum floor tax. So everybody else would have the 10% minimum floor tax except for the small producers. Section 3 of the bill is the new three-tiered progressivity approach. The subsection 1 on page 4, line 19, is for existing production in legacy fields. That progressivity would be calculated no progressivity in the severance tax below $60 gross value at the point of production. At $60, a progressivity rate of 0.27% is applied. At $120, a 16.2% tax rate is reached. At that point, progressivity is reduced to 0.03%. And it's capped at 20%. And again, this is for existing production in the legacy fields. The progressivity calculation that I just mentioned is subsection A on page 4, line 27, and subsection B on page 5, line 2. On page 5, line 9.
Yeah, we could just slow down.
Sure.
We got all afternoon here.
Okay. If there are any questions, I'll move on to the incremental production.
Go ahead.
That is on page 5, line 9. That defines what the incremental production is. The producer that produces taxable oil in 2008 and 2011 and produces a volume of taxable oil for the year in excess of the target volume determining Q, which I'll get to later, then the amount of the tax is calculated as follows. No progressivity below 60% gross value at the point of production, $60. At $60, the progressivity rate of 0.14% is applied. At $120, an 8.4% tax rate is reached. At that point, progressivity is then reduced to 0.03% and capped at 10%. That's the intermediate progressivity for the incremental production in the legacy fields. On page 5, line 28, is the definition for new production. It's a 7-year window. The new production that from the start, the production for 7 years, whichever, or December 31st, 2012, whichever is later, that new production outside of the legacy fields would be calculated as follows. No progressivity below $60 gross value. At $60, a progressivity rate of 0.05% is applied, and then progressivity is capped at 5%. On page 6, line 1, I wanted to point out for the committee that It reads, "From a lease or property containing land that was not previously, or previously had not been within a unit or a commercial production before January 1, 2008, is the new production progressivity calculation. We picked the January 1, 2008 date with the intention of picking up Nikaichuk and Uguruk. So they are, they will be under the new production calculation, the lowest tier of the progressivity. Section 4 of the bill on page 6, line 11. This adjusts the $60 base amount by the annual percent increase in the United States Consumer Price Index. This indexation will avoid the stealth tax that Mr. Mayor of PFC Energy advised us on. Page 6, also section 4, lines 23 through 29, is the production decline calculation. To the target volume equals the volume of oil produced by a producer in 2011 multiplied by the decline percentage calculated by using the cube root square root method. And this sets a fixed decline on a particular time going forward to incentivize all the incremental production in our legacy fields. Mr. Chairman, all the rest of the sections remain the same as in the previous version. The only difference is that sections 13 and 14 are the effective dates. The only change there was that the Petroleum Information Management System would take effect immediately, but the rest of the sections of the bill take effect January 1, 2013. Those are all the changes in the CS, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Do we have any more objection, any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, version O then is our working document in front of us. With that, we'll have PFC Energy come forward, please. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and please.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I'm a manager in the upstream and gas practice at PFC Energy and project manager for this engagement that we are undertaking for the Alaska State Legislature, contracted through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to assist the legislature in analysis on the question of oil and gas fiscal terms reform.
It looks like, Mr. Mayer, you've been here so many times in front of Senate Finance that you can pour water and introduce yourself at the same time. It's getting rather robotic. We got a few more days. We have for the public today is some updated slides dealing with some decline curve questions that the committee had, and then some rankings. So as we've evolved this piece of legislation and adjusted the progressivity slopes and trigger points, and then had work done on the incremental production issue in Prudhoe and Kuparuk, I thought it'd be nice if Mr. Mayer came forward and talked a little bit about that incremental production issue, because it gets a little complex on occasion, and then brief the committee on where they think Alaska then would kind of fit in relative to some of the other more prolific oil basins around the world. Go ahead, Mr. Mayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To start on the decline curve issue, we've talked a little over the last several days about the question of how to use some sort of decline methodology to incentivize production above that decline curve, above the rate that we think is being produced into the future simply through ongoing existing profitable investment to provide some form of additional incentive to get production above those levels. We looked at previous amendments that either incentivize production simply above the previous year's production, meaning that one would actually need a truly enormous new development given the existing decline to not only get above that decline but actually have incremental production in any given year above the previous year. We also looked at a couple of suggestions and amendments from Senate Resources Committee that would have calculated a decline curve but looked at incentivizing above that decline curve when the decline itself was calculated on a rolling average and when the incentive was applied this year to production above a target set based on last year's production. So each year the amount that can be incentivized through such a method is very small because it's only in any given year production compared to last year, less a decline curve. And not only that, but if you actually do achieve new production, you, of course, face the problem that instead, after a few years of having a decline curve that you're trying to beat, you actually have an incline curve because of the effect of that rolling average. And so what we've discussed is the question of, instead, to actually have an increasing benefit to a producer who does manage to produce above whatever is predicted by some decline curve, one actually needs to fix that decline at this point in time and project it forward. One needs some basis of looking back on prior production, forecasting forward a decline curve, and saying that for all production above that level, whatever improved terms one wants to adopt, those are adopted for all of that production. And so in these two charts, we see on the left the effect of, for instance, if we were to take the DOR forecast of production for out until 2032 and treat this hypothetically simply as production from a single producer, what that would look like if, in terms of the incentive calculated on a rolling average basis and applied only each year compared to production each year compared to the target set from the previous year, versus if we set that decline target at one point in time, forecast it forward, and the amount of incremental production you then get above that and what that looks like as an incentive. Crucial then is, to that question, is then the issue of, well, what decline rate does one use? There are a number of approaches that one could use. One would be to say, we're simply going to pick a number, say 6% is one that's been thrown around quite a lot, and that's the curve for everyone. Another approach would be to say, asset by asset, we're going to look at this and forecast a curve for each one. And from a technical perspective, that could well be the best approach to take. It's also a very complex one in terms of then needing to track each stream of production that goes with each asset. And judge how much of it is incentivized by being production above a decline curve and all the rest. If one isn't to do that, then the third option is to do essentially what that sort of the tax holiday proposal that we've discussed in the past sought to do, which was to calculate a decline curve on a company portfolio basis. But and even one can take a very similar approach in terms of calculating what that curve is, but rather than do it on that rolling average basis, again, to fix it at this point and extend it forward and each year see how much production is above that forecast, that target line. So if we were to do that, and look, for instance, at company portfolios over recent years, what might the decline rates set on the basis of that historical performance be? Now, the CS, as it currently stands, anticipates that being done on the basis of 2011 production, and looking at the difference between 2008 production and 2011 production and the decline rate that implies, and then simply extending that decline forward into the future. If I look on the AOGCC website, I don't currently see 2011 production data, but I do have 2010. So I've done the same exercise here. First of all, looking at the gap between 2007 and 2010, so a similar exercise but with data for 1 year previous, and then looking at if, for comparison, if it weren't that four-year window between 08 and 11, or in this case 07 and 10, but instead 06 and 2010 or 05 and 2010, what would that look like instead? And so what you see here is essentially not a timeline, but a sensitivity of, in each case here, an average is being taken where the average ends in 2010, and what's on the horizontal axis is the start year for that calculation. So starting all the way back in 1995, for instance, versus starting in 2006 or starting in 2007. This is an approximation in many ways. It takes the publicly available production data and then applies what is known publicly in terms of equity stakes for each of the companies in those assets. There is probably several subtleties in the questions of ownership and all those other things that doesn't capture, and so these are just approximations. But it was one place to start for some hasty analysis to at least see what this would look like for different producers. What we see is, on the basis of that four-year window, 2007 to 2010, for instance, we see a decline curve for ExxonMobil on that basis of a little over 6%, but significantly higher curves for BP and ConocoPhillips, for instance, concentrating on the three major producers since they're obviously the most affected by this. And those higher curves, from what I can tell from looking through the data, probably principally come from the higher decline that we see for Kuparuk than we see for some of the other assets. So, for example, if I move to the next slide, to slide 4, and look just at doing that same calculation, so again, the horizontal axis being that question of what year does the average start, when the average finishes in 2010 for all of them, and what we see is, again, particularly in the recent years, higher rates of decline for Kuparuk versus Prudhoe Bay. And to go back once again to slide 3, that's the reason why in those more recent years we see relatively high rate of decline for those two producers versus for ExxonMobil. Of course, what this means is that higher rates of decline mean of course, a steeper decline curve forecast on the basis of that methodology, and more room for incentive, relatively speaking. So one of the questions that the committee has to ponder is whether that company-wide approach is the best one to take, or whether, for instance, simply setting a flat rate that applies to everyone is the best one to take. And there are a number of arguments to be made around all of those issues. Simply for information, it gets a little much to show on one chart, which is why mostly I concentrated on looking simply at Prudhoe and Kuparuk. But if we look at all of the units, what that looks like, a couple of these go off the chart, and I've kept it at a maximum of a 20% decline curve simply for the sake of legibility. But we can see the high rate of variability that we then have between different assets in looking at their decline curves, again, calculated on that same basis.
Before we go on to the next subject, I guess, would be some competitive issues. Do we have any questions on the methodology on the decline curve? Why it was selected or anything on it? Okay. Go ahead and continue, Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second section of these slides is simply an updated version of the slides we presented earlier about relative government take as a benchmarking exercise, again using those same sort of stylized cash flow profiles that we've talked about before of both for an existing producer and then for a new development. The existing producer having relatively low levels of costs, I think around $12 a barrel in OPEX and a modest amount of CAPEX, and then higher level of costs for a new development, and a new development being one undertaken not for an existing producer but for someone who has no existing production, and thus a somewhat decreased ability to write off some of that capex that occurs at the start of production against an existing tax liability. The costs for the new producer in there, again, as we discussed, are about $17 a barrel in both OPEX and CAPEX. Now, those are very rough figures put together essentially to reflect a new light oil development relatively close to existing infrastructure, probably, for instance, for a producer, relatively high OPEX, but high-ish but not as high as one might imagine, capital expenditures, for instance, in the case of a producer who has access to existing facilities but has to pay a premium for using them because they're not their own facilities. On the capital expenditure front in particular, though, it's important to remember that for development further from existing infrastructure, for instance, for a producer seeking to pull together new production further out, for instance, toward NPRA with absolutely no existing infrastructure, possibly sort of seeking to drill tight or more viscous oil, for instance, those costs could be significantly in excess of that, and government take would rise accordingly. So that's an important qualifier that I wanted to add to that analysis. Second thing to add here is that on all of these slides, most of the elements that are in front of you in CSSB 192 are included in this analysis, but there is an important one that isn't, which is the question of the indexing of the breakpoint at which progressivity starts to inflation. Haven't yet had time to incorporate that in this analysis, and that would reduce government take very slightly in some of these cases, and we can certainly work on getting that into the model, but it takes a little more work than we've had time for at this point.
Could you help me a little bit here with this on page 6? You've got the Bill 92 existing producer and ACES existing producer. So why wouldn't we be below ACES?
At $60 a barrel, including the impact of indexing for inflation, we should be exactly line ball with ACES. What you're seeing there, I think, is precisely the impact of not including that indexing for inflation, and then therefore that progressivity at the $60 level kicking in at lower price levels when we look across 30-plus year time horizon. So it's an excellent question, Mr. Chair, and when we've had a chance to incorporate into the model the question of the indexing, what we would see at $60 a barrel is absolutely no difference between the two.
There would be no difference in what?
Between ACES and CSSB 192. In fact, it may be slightly lower because of the impact of the indexing. Right. But without the impact of the indexing, as we said before, the question of inflation has a disproportionate impact on 192 versus on ACES, because the tax is on the gross rather than on the net, and which is one of the things that makes the indexing particularly important. But that's what you're seeing reflected there at $60 a barrel. As we look at higher rates, we, of course, get into the opposite situation where CSSB 192 is significantly below ACES.
So just on a lighter moment, if we wanted to be better in North Dakota, we'd just keep our price at $60.
you do in DC high levels of take, and I note that those U.S. states, Texas, Louisiana, North Dakota, appear twice in this chart. They also appear again lower down, the difference being for the question of what those states look like for unconventionals versus what they look like for conventional onshore production. The difference there is not a difference of fiscal regime, it's a difference of costs associated with those sorts of developments. Those are, of course, all, relatively speaking, flat royalty type states that are quite regressive in nature, so that as costs rise, particularly in low price environments, take can be relatively high. So at $60 a barrel, North Dakota, Texas, and Louisiana are relatively speaking, still quite low for conventional oil production, but they get high for the unconventionals at those price levels precisely because of the interaction of high costs for the unconventionals with the fixed royalty. As soon as we get to even slightly higher price levels, what you'll see is those fall away immediately. Okay. So at $60 a barrel, as you can see, there are a number of precisely as you point out, those U.S. states solely in the case of the unconventionals are higher, for instance, some even than Norway, and the current regime is not so poorly placed. But as soon as we get to $80 a barrel, ACES is the second highest among the OECD regimes. But still, particularly 192, not looking terrible compared to Texas and Louisiana, for instance, at $80 a barrel. As soon as we get to $100 a barrel, though, as I say, those fixed royalty regimes drop significantly down to somewhere in the mid-60% take level, whereas we see ACES for an existing producer at, I think, around 74% at that level. CSSB 192, again, based on those on that sort of $12 OPEX figure and $5 in CAPEX, lower than that at just over 70%. As we've discussed, of course, that is a figure that's sensitive to the question of costs. So increasing costs, particularly in the case of existing production, increasing operating costs can impact that and make that look better or worse, depending. By $120 a barrel, this, of course, is where the systems then start to diverge, and what we see is significant increases in progressivity under ACES at those price levels, while government take for CSSB 192 increases much less significantly. And because at that sort of price level, a number of other of the non-OECD regimes also increase significantly in government take, we start to see some widening between 192 versus ACES for existing production on that basis, although the percentage gap remains modest at that price level. At 140, that gap increases quite dramatically to the point where ACES for an existing producer is equal to and indeed slightly above Norway and becomes the highest government take level for the OECD, whereas CSSB 192 at that point hits that sort of 73-odd% split that we've seen holding constant in some of the analysis and essentially stays there from that point onward at the higher price levels. So if we move to $160, for instance, again, we see CSSB 192 in the same place while ACES has moved further up the system. And that impact is only further exacerbated if we look at it then, for instance, at $180 a barrel, where by these price levels, CSSB 192 is much closer, though still a little higher, than HV 110 levels, given these price assumptions, while ACES is dramatically higher, and that only increases further in terms of that disparity when we reach $200 a barrel. To look then at the same set of slides and price decks, but looking at what things look like for a new development, we do see at $60 a barrel, again, these are all clustered quite close together. There's only a few percentage points in between them, and again, that question of the indexing of inflation, once that's brought into play, that should actually completely even the field between ACES and CSSB 192 at $60 a barrel. That difference is again accounted for solely through the question of the impact of inflation over the life cycle of a project. If we look then at what it looks like at 80 again, we have ACES moving ahead and getting up to levels about equal to Norway. And as we move up the deck, ACES gets further and further up, well into the mid and then the high 70s, so by $120 a barrel, getting close to 80% government take for a new producer, while CSSB 192 then again settles around that sort of the low 70% mark and stays there.
If we can just stop there, I mean, if we could, page 17, I guess, is as good as 16. I was going to ask the question on 16, but the impact that inflation would have on the new development for 192, what effect would that have on this ranking?
With all of them, it's certainly worth a couple of percentage points, I would say, in government take. But it will take some work to adapt the model to be able to run those results accurately. So I'd like, if I could, to be able to do that over the next day or two and get that analysis to you.
Right, you're going to add that into your model for next week?
Certainly.
Right. Because people will look at the model and it would be nice to have it indexed in there, since we've got inflation in the CS, and then it'll give a better reflection of what the ranking would actually be.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. What we see, though, again, is as we move to progressively higher price levels, ACE is moving further and further up the deck until it sort of joins the ranks of a Turkmenistan or an Oman or an Azerbaijan at 140, while CSSB 192, again, stays fixed at around that 72-73% government take figure. HB 110, of course, for new development, is significantly below that. This is CSSB 192 for new development, including the impact of the 7-year reduction down to a 5% cap in progressivity in the early years, but then for the rest of the life cycle of the asset, the standard rate applied out into the distance. HB 110, of course, for new development, still significantly below what we see here, and that, of course, is the impact of the reduced 15% base under that scenario. And then as we move further up the deck, up to $180 and $200 a barrel, we again see that significant difference where ACE is at those levels is again getting into the mid 80% government take and among the very highest levels of government take in the world at those price levels, and CSSB 192, along with ACEs for new development, remaining at those price levels above what we would see for most conceivable developments in the lower 48, but substantially below, for instance, where we see Norway at that price level.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question has come in regarding slide 8. I know it's a backtrack, but if you could humor me. And the question is, if revenue is neutral at $100 a barrel, why the disparity in government take? So that relates to slide 8. And then also there's a question of, if Janet could speak to the impact of indexing at all levels. But slide 8 first.
Senator Ellis, through the chair, CSSB 192, as analyzed in the context of 2013 financials and the assumptions that go with that, is indeed revenue neutral at $100 a barrel. The cost assumptions one makes are critical to the question of whether it's neutral, higher or lower. In this case, for the new development, while the operating cost figures that are being used are similar, possibly in fact a little higher, but not dissimilar to the figures for financial year 2013 as an average for the slope. The figures that have been used throughout the analysis when this is presented purely for a declining existing producer have lower capex than that, because it's separating out the capital investment that goes with new production versus the capital investment that just maintains a steady decline. And in that sense, it's those lower costs that show a slightly lower take at that level. And once again, the impact of
indexing
is again, at all of these price levels, simply to reduce government take on the life cycle basis. If we come back, of course, to the financials that we were looking at the other day for 2013. It has no impact, of course, when one looks at a given year, particularly for the coming fiscal year. But when one looks over the life cycle of a project, the impact of indexing is to slightly reduce government take further, as one no longer has the effect of bracket creep, meaning that progressivity kicks in at progressively lower and lower levels in real terms.
So the indexing is to maintain the relationship, to make the architecture durable, sustainable, but why at the expense of the citizen take? Why not neutral in maintaining the relationship?
Senator Ellis, through the chair, the idea is indeed to make the system durable and sustainable. It's at the expense of the citizenry only in as far as one measures the difference between that and ACES, or between that and doing it without. And in that sense, what I'm saying is it's reduced take compared to a system where steadily year after year the state manages secretly to take a little bit more because of the impact of inflation. That's I'm not sure that's necessarily the best comparison. All it's doing is it's taking out that stealth tax effect that comes from the state each year being able to take a little bit more because the threshold doesn't shift with the actual value of money.
I see. Thank you.
So to ask it another way, if we would have indexed ACES, then they would be equal?
If we were to index ACES, that would also somewhat reduce the impact of government take under ACES. I need to run the numbers to be absolutely certain of this. My strong intuition on this is that the impact of indexing should be at least a little greater on CSSB 192 than on ACES, solely because of the difference between the levelling of the tax on the net versus on the gross and the sensitivity to costs that comes with that.
Any questions for Mr. Mayor? So you'll modify your spiffy model so you can, it'll run index numbers and redo the charts and for us for next week?
That work is in progress even as we speak, Mr. Chair.
I think some of the members would, well, I know they're going to be referenced, these charts will be referenced, and it'd be nice to have the inflation index in it. I guess then we could actually compare the two and see the difference, hypothetically. Senator Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize if this was covered when I wasn't available in the discussion, but a number of us have been, it's been commented to us from industry representatives that the modeling hasn't adequately taken into account company costs, and I have confidence in the model and the work of our consultant. But could we give Mr. Mayor an opportunity to speak to that, the cost, company cost elements for production at various fields and various companies, different business models that they have, what he's accounted for in his model for company costs?
Okay.
If this is the time to defend that, or if it's another time, maybe the best time is now. I wanted to give him an opportunity to speak to that because a number of us have been approached. Lots of compliments and lots of respect for your modeling, but on that point, there's been some fairly severe criticism, and I think you should have a chance to address that.
Absolutely, Senator Ross. Through the chair, I appreciate the opportunity. I'd say a couple of things. The vast majority of the analysis that we've been looking at over the last couple of days as this has solidified as the proposal has been in terms of financial year 2013 numbers and over those, I think, in terms of what things look like as an aggregate in 2013, there's probably relatively little dispute. Through the course of this analysis, both for the perspective of showing relative government take compared to other jurisdictions and to give people a flavour of what this looks like in different scenarios, we've used a couple of very stylized field development models to show what this might look like for an existing producer, particularly in terms of levels of government take, what it might look for a new development. To focus on those two issues separately, in terms of costs for an existing producer, I think there are a number of questions. For instance, whether one is looking solely at costs that are claimable in ACES because the impact is to look at the fiscal system and the impact that the government take, as opposed to when an existing producer is running their own economics and to see what their business looks like in the long term, where they may run with much higher costs, not costs that they can deduct under ACEs, but much higher costs, which again don't change the question of the level of government take under ACEs, but those much higher costs do impact the question of the durability of their business and how desirable it is. So I think that there are two different questions there, particularly in terms of different numbers for operating costs that they may be thrown or may be used. One is the question of costs that are deductible under the fiscal system. The other is the question of what the actual picture of the business looks like, which isn't what we've been concentrating on here. On the question of new development, for instance, as I highlighted in before presenting these slides, the costs that have been modelled there are ones that we think are a reasonable representation of what a new light oil development, not enormously far from existing production, looks like. As I see the economics that very stylized cash flow produces, those are not economics massively different to what I would expect to see, for instance, for some of the recent new developments that we have seen on the slope in the near offshore, for instance. As one goes further away from existing infrastructure, as one drills for hydrocarbons that are not simply light oil, but either things that are more viscous or tight reservoirs where one is drilling complex, expensive horizontal wells using hydraulic fracturing and other things, I would expect costs to go up significantly. If there's a desire to see some analysis on that, we can certainly do that. This has again been an analysis to say, in recent experience, for recent developments, what does some of this look like?
Thank you.
We have other questions for Mr. Mayor today? He's going to escape our clutches for several days and be back Monday. So we won't have any of the new updated information till then. So if you want other stuff run or analysis run, let me know and we'll get it in the hopper. Or if you want further definitions or descriptions of stuff, we'll have them work on it so you can have all the information you want in whatever format committee members deem that they need it. Okay. With that, I guess we'll reconvene at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning with some invited testimony on the CS. We are adjourned.